This is Radio Health Journal, a weekly news magazine with the latest in health, medicine, and technology. A closer look at the issues that affect your health and well-being. Prevention, lifestyles, treatments, and trends, all from the nation's top experts. I'm Shel Lustig.
I'm Nancy Benson.
And I'm Reed Pence. This week, the benefits of sports at school, especially for young women. You may be surprised.
There's obviously over the years been a lot of research on the effect of participating in sports, particularly on students' achievement. For a long time, we had this debate over dumb jocks versus the quote-unquote student athlete.
Then, a look at the decision-making process. What's going on in our heads when we simply can't make a decision?
Unless we listen to our emotions for just a second, we'll be stuck in this loop of rationality and never make a decision at all.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 800-317-0164. Now you have the qualified help in dealing with the IRS. This is the second chance you never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 800-317-0164. Call right now for your second chance. 800-317-0164. That's 800-317-0164.
The nation's economic decline has affected just about everyone. Families and corporations have been forced to cut back and make do with less. States and cities have less money to fix roads and hire police officers. And many schools are pondering which programs to cut to balance their budgets. Today, school districts succeed or fail based on their students' test scores. So it's almost automatic for school boards to cut sports, music, and other non-core academics and extracurriculars. But some experts wonder if those assumptions about relative value are correct.
We absolutely can make comparisons, and in fact, I think schools have to make these comparisons and decide how beneficial are each of the activities that kids engage in, and how costly are they. So what will they save when they cut something, and what will they potentially lose?
Dr. Betsy Stevenson is assistant professor of economics at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania.
I hear parents say all the time that when it comes to class size, we can't afford not to have small classes for our kids. But what does that mean, we can't afford not to have small classes for our kids? You know, I think it's worthwhile for a school system to say, hey, how much will it hurt these kids if we put three more kids in the classroom and make sure that we have a sports program for them after school versus not having the sports program and cutting our class size?
Stevenson admits those kinds of evaluations are difficult. How much benefit does a student get from taking one more math class, one more science class, or even one more full year?
When you add up all those returns, there's a big missing gap. In other words, the returns to an extra year of high school are bigger than the sum of the returns to each of the classes you took while you were in that extra year. And so we're sort of left wondering, where do those extra returns come from? Why the big gain from another year of high school when it's not coming from the classes you're taking?
Stevenson says her research shows that interscholastic sports is one of the extracurriculars that should get credit. She focused on young women who were affected by Title IX, the 1972 federal law equalizing opportunities in boys and girls' sports in schools. Within 6 years of the law's passage, sports participation nationwide increased from less than 4% of high school girls to 25%. By making state-by-state comparisons, Stevenson was able to quantify the benefits of high school sports in the lives of women who had played them. She found that female athletes ended up with more education and made more money.
Now, if we were just comparing athletes and non-athletes, the gap is actually quite large. Athletes tend to have about a year's more schooling than non-athletes and earn 14% higher wages. But a lot of that gap that we see in the difference in the outcomes between athletes and non-athletes comes from the characteristics of the type of people who choose to play sports. When we try to account for that, in other words, take into account things like your family characteristics, your school characteristics, even a person's underlying ability, we find that much of that gap goes away, but not all. So once we start to take account of those things, we see that wage difference falls to 7%, and the difference in schooling is about a third of a year instead of a full year. But there's still a big gap there.
Another study has found that playing high school sports increases the odds that a young woman will graduate from college by 41%. And as Stevenson says, it's more than the fact that richer, smarter kids are more likely to go into sports in the first place.
But we're still left wondering, you know, what is it that's doing that? Is it the increased time in a structured setting? Is it the increased pressure or interactions from peers? Is it the increased attention from adults? You're staying after school, getting more adult supervision while you're participating in sports. Is it interacting with a more diverse crowd? You know, the people who play on your sporting team might be more diverse than who you would normally hang out with. Is it having a more disciplined lifestyle? If you have to go to practice after school, you are going to have to fit your homework in at a certain time. There's less time for goofing off. Is it the things that's crowding out? If you're playing sports after school, you're not hanging out at the shopping mall or doing something else that might be detrimental to you.
My folks looked at it as it kept me busy and kept me out of trouble. And as I got older, there was a lot to be said for that. The busier you were, the less time you had to get into trouble. The busier you were, the more you had to be good at time management. I look at myself and the many, many benefits, and not just shooting, but I ran track, I ran cross country, I did sports in grade school.
That's Nancy Napolsky-Johnson, the 1994 NCAA champion and 2000 Olympic gold medalist in air rifle. One of the other sports she did back in junior high was basketball, playing on a team that I helped coach. She was one of those kids that you just know will be successful in life. But she says it's the determination born of not succeeding that makes many athletes winners later on.
I vividly remember my coach telling my dad, well, she's pretty good at this, you know, right at the beginning, but I wasn't. And it took failure after failure after failure after second place. You know, you don't always make the podium. And that was something certainly that kept me coming back day in and day out. That was really where I found my niche. And boy, talk about a boost to self-esteem when you find something that you're good at.
I certainly can reflect on my own personal experience and think about the individual benefits of, you know, feeling like, hey, this might be hard, but I can do this, and getting the feedback through sports and then learning that I could do that in other areas of my life as well.
Beckett Breaux was a three-sport athlete in high school. Now she's assistant professor of sociology at Capital University, whose research shows that self-esteem and the sense of accomplishment are among the big benefits of participating in sports in school. She found that controlling for all other factors, students get better grades and higher test scores as a result of participating in interscholastic sports. And she was able to find out why.
Participating in sports, not surprisingly, helps students build self-esteem and a sense of control over outcomes, and that seemed to explain about a third of their growth in academic achievement relative to students that didn't play interscholastic sports.
That's really no surprise, but Breaux wanted to test another theory as well, one that she developed over 10 years coaching high school basketball and soccer. She saw that her athletes talked with adults in ways that were often much different than other kids.
They seemed to have, generally, very positive relationships with their parents, that they talked openly with their parents about issues that some of my non-athletes that I was working with in the high school didn't seem to do as much. And that was really what spawned this research was, you know, does playing sports help students build better relationships with their parents? And then in turn, it kind of grew into this much broader study. Certainly, I think the activity itself provides young adolescents with topics to talk to their parents about that are comfortable and that open the door for other conversations. Certainly traveling to and from practices and games and spending time together before and after games, I think builds opportunity for students to build their relationships not only with their peer groups, but also with their parents and potentially coaches who might also be teachers.
Bro says that peer groups are different for high school athletes compared to non-athletes as well, though the effect of that is not clear.
It does seem that students that participate in interscholastic sports seem to spend more time with students who feel that it's important to attend class, feel that it's important to study, who have aspirations of going to college after high school. So it did seem that it put them in a more academically oriented peer group. I wasn't able to make a link between that and the actual benefits of participating on achievement.
But what about kids who are interested in sports, but just not good enough athletes to make the team? That happens a lot in big high schools. Will those students get some of the same benefits from participating in intramural sports? Bro says no. In fact, those students show a decline in achievement that's even bigger than the increase enjoyed by interscholastic athletes.
Anybody who's familiar with the educational environment of high schools knows that there is a very large difference between participating in an interscholastic sports versus an intramural sport. For example, if in an interscholastic sport, you're meeting with your team almost daily, there is competition, there is a sense of identity and unity within your school versus other schools, whereas in intramural sports, there is no coach, there's no necessary cohesive team, no real sense of competition where a loss is meaningful for them. And I think also in light of some of the results of my research, you would also wonder about the status of students playing, meaning the social prestige of playing an interscholastic sport versus, say, an intramural sport that only occurs intermittently and is more for fun than it is for competition.
So are kids who aren't athletically oriented doomed to be one step behind? Not necessarily. Bro found that students involved in music at school also increased their grades and test scores. She didn't investigate how that happens, but one can speculate that some of the same processes are at work. Students and teachers are working hard toward a common goal. They experience achievement and the beneficial social capital of close-knit relationships. It's a different kind of team.
And that's really what this idea of social capital gets at, is building relationships, particularly for adolescents who are at a very important developmental stage, to build social ties with adults that are long-lasting and that go beyond whatever realm they're building the relationship in. For example, a non-athlete might know a math teacher as a math teacher and talk to that math teacher only when they're going in and out of math class, whereas an athlete might, you know, get stopped by that math teacher in the hall and say, hey, how was your game last night? Who won? And start talking about other things. And that those relationships really build and last, not only with coaches, but also with other adults that might just be connected to those students because they're known as athletes or because they have something to talk about. I still have athletes, former athletes, calling me today saying, you know, Coach Bro, I might take this job. What do you think about it?
I vividly remember after the 2000 Olympics, somebody was actually an agent that I had for a very short time, but he told me I couldn't give credit to anybody for my medal except to myself. And I laughed at him. I said, are you kidding me? Look who helped me along the way. It was really every person that I encountered from a very young age who believed in me.
Research results, however, leave school boards in a tough spot. Cutting extracurriculars or non-core academics isn't an easy answer. In fact, Bro says what kids do outside the three R's may be the only thing that keeps some students in the classroom.
Extracurriculars are not only directly linked, as is shown in the study, to achievement, but we know that they're linked to a much broader educational outcome that we call educational engagement or student engagement, meaning that students who are at risk of things like dropping out or performing poorly, if they're connected to the school in a meaningful way that's important to them through sports, through music, through theater, they seem to do better, you know, such that we hang on to students who otherwise might drop out or hang on to students that otherwise might fail a class in ways that are really important. So extracurriculars, in my perspective, given my knowledge of the research, are critical to truly providing high school students with the educational experience they need to achieve both in the classroom and then ultimately when they get out into the real world.
I'm Reed Pence.
Coming up, the chemical process in the brain that translates into decisions, when Radio Health Journal continues.
Hi, folks. Peter Epstein, president of Merit Financial, the Gold People. With the changing economy, you probably know how important it is to protect your wealth. But did you know that gold can give you an edge when other investments are down? At Merit Financial, we make it easy to get the right gold at the right price right away. Surveys show we beat other major companies' prices by up to 20%. That's 20% more gold for your money. The Merit Guarantee is simple. We'll beat any advertised price on the products we offer. And we guarantee every piece of gold is individually inspected to assure the highest quality. Call Merit right now and I'll send you our gold investment guide absolutely free. Find out why so many people choose Merit for gold. Call right now for your free gold guide.
Call 1-877-646-8484. Call right now for your free gold investment guide. Call 1-877-646-8484. That's 1-877-646-8484.
Human beings are at the top of the animal world, or so we would like to think. Our brains set us apart from every other creature, and it's when we rationally think through decisions that we most strongly display that attribute. We pore through consumer reports before we buy a new car. We check the ratings before we pick a new doctor. We write down the pros and cons before we accept a new job.
We've exalted rationality for so long, and ever since Plato, we've been telling ourselves that the best way to think is to always be rational. To always think things through clearly, to deliberate, to make long lists of pros and cons, to crunch the numbers. I mean, this is what Plato told us. This is what economists tell us. And yet, when you look at the brain, when you actually look at these 3 pounds of meat stuffed inside our head, you quickly realize that we're not nearly as rational as we like to think.
That's Jonah Lehrer, a contributing editor at Scientific American Mind and author of the book, How We Decide, an examination of the chemical processes going on in our heads. For example, how does an NFL quarterback find an open receiver before he gets pounded to the turf? It's not something he has time to ponder. Lehrer says when a huge amount of information has to be processed in a split second, emotions become an important part of the decision-making process.
What you find is that the emotional brain is really another name for the unconscious. And the unconscious is taking in all this information, all these facts of the world that we're not aware of. So if it's a quarterback, it's taking into account these 21 other players in the field, where the linebackers are, where the cornerbacks are, if the offensive line is holding. All this information is simply too much information for the rational brain to handle. So what happens is the unconscious takes it in, processes it, and then generates an emotion to tell us what to do. So emotions really are a sign that we know more than we know, that awareness is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to what the brain is up to. And your emotions are simply an insight, a window into all the other stuff that's going on inside your head.
Lehrer says those unconscious decisions are often remarkably accurate. That's because the unconscious mind has instant access to all of our experience. The result may be a crude gut feeling, but it's usually right.
This is one of the reasons I don't like to call them instincts, because I think people tend to assume instincts are just these hardwired things, you know, that you simply can't resist. But our emotions are really shaped by experience, that they're very plastic and malleable, and they change in response to practice. So much of what we call expertise is really just well-trained emotions, which are a virtue of making mistakes and then learning from those mistakes. And that kind of experience really gets embedded in your emotions.
Lehrer's experience making decisions is what led him to write the book. He says he is chronically indecisive and wanted to know why. He found out that the phrase paralysis by analysis describes him to a T.
My wife would always yell at me because I'd spend 20 minutes trying to figure out which breakfast cereal I wanted to buy. You know, Honey Nut Cheerios, Apple Cinnamon Cheerios, Multigrain Cheerios, then they got Banana Nut Cheerios. I mean, you know, there are all these different options. How do we ever know what we want? And it turns out that that kind of paralysis by analysis is very common. And what it seems to be caused by is a shortage of emotion. So we're thinking too much. We're coming up with all sorts of reasons why we should pick option A instead of option B, or option C instead of option D. And unless we listen to our emotions for just a second, we'll be stuck in this loop of rationality and never make a decision at all. So that's, you know, I think a clear everyday example of how sometimes the problem is we're just thinking too much.
Lehrer found a perfect example in the case of Elliot, a man who'd had a brain tumor. The tumor was successfully removed, but in the process, the connection to his emotional brain was severed.
Although he still scored really well on IQ tests, he was in the 97th percentile, so a very smart guy. And if you met him on the street, you might think he was just perfectly normal. It turned out that Elliot had lost the ability to experience emotions. So all those everyday feelings of pleasure and pain and anxiety that we take for granted, he just didn't experience. Now, if you were Plato or if you were a modern economist, you might think that, gee, well, Elliot must make the best decisions possible then, because, you know, he doesn't have these impulsive feelings leading him astray, leading him to eat too much ice cream or take out a subprime mortgage or charge too much on his credit card. So he's like a philosopher king, right? He's just purely rational. But instead, what you found is that Elliot really had a disease, that Elliot was pathologically indecisive, that he would spend all day trying to figure out where to eat lunch so the restaurant would be closed and it'd be too late. It would take him an hour to choose whether to use a blue pen or a black pen. So all these very banal, everyday decisions we all take for granted, Elliot just couldn't make.
So it turns out that pure reason isn't a gift, it's a disease. But people can't let their emotions take over completely either. For example, Las Vegas has learned how to cash in on our emotional brain's susceptibility to an occasional burst of dopamine.
That's the curse of the slot machine, is that over the long run, everybody loses. I mean, these are machines programmed to only return between 70 and 90 cents on the dollar. So over the long run, everybody loses. But in the short run, we get these surprising rewards coming back at us. You know, the coins clang, the sirens go off. It's very exciting. And you can understand this in terms of dopamine neurons, which is a specific type of neuron that emits a chemical in your brain. And these cells, it turns out, are very excited by surprising rewards. So nothing is more exciting to them than a surprising reward. And that is why Vegas is so alluring, because even though we're losing money, every once in a while we get these surprising rewards in return. And those surprising rewards are simply so exciting for our brain that sometimes we just can't walk away. So even though we're losing money, our brain finds it fun. And I think the virtue of learning about why your brain is so intrigued by slot machines and the roulette wheel is that it, you know, perhaps might help us get over it.
Flaws like that can lead to extremely costly mistakes and are why Lehrer says we can't trust our guts completely. On Wall Street, for example, we can't invest using our emotional brains. That's one reason the economy crashed in 2008.
When it comes to the financial crisis, one of the big important flaws has to do with the impatience of the emotional brain, the fact that it really wants rewards and it wants them right away. So you look at subprime mortgages, how they're structured. The most popular subprime mortgage is what's known as the 2.28, which means you got a discounted interest rate for 2 years, and then it would reset, and you tend to have a very high rate for the next 28 years. Of course, that makes no rational sense, because over the lifetime of the loan, you end up paying out a lot more money. But from the perspective of the brain, it was pretty tempting, because you got this immediate reward of a house at a really low rate. And because we tend to discount the future, because we tend to downplay its importance, people didn't realize or didn't think nearly enough about the whole lifetime of the loan. The fact that, geez, but for the next 28 years, for the rest of the life of the mortgage, I'm going to be paying way too much money. So because we're tempted by short-term rewards, I think these mortgages took advantage of this flaw built into the brain.
Credit cards suffer from the same irrationality. When we spend cash, areas of the brain light up with discomfort, but they don't when we pay with plastic. It's as if our minds don't think we're spending any money at all. And when it comes to romance, Lehrer says you can throw rationality completely out the window. Charles Darwin was one of the great thinkers who tried to deny it. He composed a long list of pros and cons as he tried to decide whether to get married. But eventually, he tossed that list in the trash and listened to his heart. You can find out more information about Jonah Lehrer's How We Decide by logging onto our website, radiohealthjournal.net. Our production director is Sean Waldron. I'm Nancy Benson.
Radio Health Journal returns in just a moment.
We interrupt this program with an important healthcare bulletin.
And show the American people that we can still do what we were sent here to do. Now is the time to deliver on healthcare.
Americans for Healthcare announces immediate availability of an affordable healthcare discount plan for all uninsured Americans. There is 100% acceptance regardless of medical conditions, age, income, or residency status. Over 500,000 healthcare providers nationwide. doctors, hospitals, dentists, and pharmacies, including CVS and Walgreens, are now joined with Americans for Healthcare during this critical period to bring you quality healthcare protection at 20 to 60% savings for under $3 a day. There's a daily limit of 2,000 new member registrations, so don't delay. Call now.
Call now, 800-917-8476. That's 800-917-8476. Don't delay. Only 2,000 daily registrations will be accepted. Call now, 800-917-8476.
Medical notes this week. We've previously reported on the threat of drug-resistant MRSA infections in hospitals, but a new study shows that another infection has surpassed it. Scientists at Duke University say their survey of 28 hospitals shows 25% more infections from Clostridium difficile than from MRSA. So-called C. diff bacteria resides in the colon. Infections can be antibiotic resistant, and its spores may not be killed by alcohol-based hand sanitizers. Closing up surgical wounds with staples is generally considered quicker and easier than using sutures, but a new study in the British Medical Journal shows that staples lead to more infections than stitches. Scientists discovered that stapled wounds were 3 times more likely to develop infections compared to those that had been closed with nylon sutures. And finally, dark chocolate could be heart healthy. A Harvard University study presented to the American Heart Association shows that dark chocolate could substantially lower the risk of hemorrhagic strokes caused by burst blood vessels in the brain. Scientists say women who consumed the most dark chocolate suffered 52% fewer such strokes compared to other women. Hemorrhagic strokes make up less than a quarter of all strokes. Scientists are unsure why products containing high amounts of cocoa are beneficial. And that's Medical Notes this week. More in a moment.
Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that is getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-317-0164. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-317-0164. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now, 1-800-317-0164. That's 1-800-317-0164.
And that's Radio Health Journal for this week. Radio Health Journal is a production of MediaTracks Communications. You can follow us on Twitter to learn about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on iTunes. Plus, you'll always find podcasts of our segments, information about our guests, and the latest health news at radiohealthjournal.net. Join us again next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.